Today is Tuesday. It is April 23rd, 2024. I'm Jim McPherson, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Current and the New York Times with me today is Kathy Danaher. Let's start by reviewing the photos on the front pages of these two morning newspapers. And in the Hartford Current, above the fold and across five of the six columns, we have a very large color photo of a group of people demonstrating, one of them holding a Palestinian flag in front of a columned building. The caption tells us that these are Yale students and protesters who sing rally chants as they block the intersection of College and Grove Streets on Monday outside Woolsey Hall in New Haven during a pro-Palestinian rally after about 45 students were arrested from the encampment at Beinecke Plaza on Monday morning. Protesters at Yale are seeking to have the university divest from weapons manufacturers that supply Israel with arms. Below that, we have a smaller picture of two students who are writing messages in chalk on the pavement. These are Yale protesters who write messages as they block the intersection of College and Grove Streets outside Woolsey Hall during the pro-Palestinian rally. And the messages are, "We shall not be moved," and the other reads, "Divest." Below that, we have a picture of two men in suits talking to each other. They are Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney of New Haven and Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff of Norwalk. These are leaders on pushing for a provision barring the use of Chinese-made drones by Connecticut municipalities. And on the right, we have a small picture of a woman who's smiling vibrantly into the camera. She's Enrica Amor, part of whose remains were launched into space in January. And we will cover stories associated with each of these pictures a little bit later on in the program. Moving on to the New York Times, we have a picture above the fold and across four of the six columns of an urban area that has been completely destroyed. The caption tells us that this is the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis on Monday. Palestinians have been confronted by catastrophic scenes after Israel's attacks. And then on the right, we have a small picture of former President Donald Trump. It's Donald J. Trump outside the courthouse in Manhattan on Monday. And below that, we have a group of people who are surrounding a speaker on some sort of a plaza. Protesters at Columbia University on Monday. Classes moved online to de-escalate the rancor. Those are the photos on the front pages of the two newspapers from which we'll be reading. Now for the main headline in the New York Times, let's go to Kathy Danaher.
Outlining Trump's past, prosecutors open trial beneath a global glare. Defense tells jury to use common sense. This by Jonah Bromwich and Ben Protest. Manhattan prosecutors delivered a raw recounting of Donald J. Trump's seamy past on Monday as they debuted their case against him to jurors, the nation, and the world, reducing the former president to a co-conspirator in a plot to cover up three sex scandals that threatened his 2016 election win. Their opening statement was a pivotal moment in the first prosecution of an American president, a sweeping synopsis of the case against Mr. Trump, who watched from the defense table, occasionally shaking his head. Moments later, Mr. Trump's lawyer delivered his own opening, beginning with the simple claim that, quote, "President Trump is innocent," end quote, then noting that he is once again the presumptive Republican nominee, and concluding with an exhortation for jurors to, quote, "use your common sense," end quote. The jury of 12 New Yorkers, who will weigh Mr. Trump's legal fate before millions of voters decide his political future, also heard brief testimony from the prosecution's lead-off witness, David Pecker, a former tabloid publisher who was close with Mr. Trump. Mr. Pecker, who ran the National Enquirer, testified that his supermarket's tabloids practice, quote, "checkbook journalism," end quote. In this case, prosecutors say, he bought and buried stories that could have imperiled Mr. Trump's 2016 campaign. The flurry of activity on the landmark trial's first formal day captivated jurors, many of whom jotted notes as they followed along. And it sent nervous energy through a lower Manhattan courthouse as bomb-sniffing dogs, the U.S. Secret Service, and the police patrolled the dingy building. The spectacle was a vivid reminder of the proceedings' unprecedented nature. A courthouse accustomed to cycling through trials of murderers, fraudsters, and felons of all types now had its first former president. On Monday, the proceedings ended early with little fanfare to accommodate the Passover holiday and a juror's emergency dental appointment. But it began in striking fashion with the judge, Juan M. Merchan, determining what prosecutors could ask of Mr. Trump should he take witness stand on his own defense. In a victory for the prosecution, the judge ruled that they could question him about three civil trials he lost over the last year, including a fraud case in which a different judge found him liable for conspiring to inflate his net worth and penalized him hundreds of millions of dollars. Matthew Colangelo, a senior aide to the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin L. Bragg, then seized on what he called a conspiracy in the criminal case. Over the course of a 45-minute opening, as Mr. Bragg watched from the front row, Mr. Colangelo calmly walked the jury through the prosecution's argument that Mr. Trump orchestrated the plot to corrupt the 2016 election. The scheme, he explained, involved hush money deals with three people who had salacious stories to sell: a porn star, Playboy model, and a doorman at one of Mr. Trump's buildings. Mr. Trump, who faces up to 4 years in prison, directed allies to buy those people silent to protect his candidacy. Mr. Colangelo explained, Mr. Pecker took care of the model and the doorman, while Michael D. Cohen, Mr. Trump's former fixer, who was set to be the prosecution's star witness, paid off the porn star. After taking the White House, Mr. Colangelo added, Mr. Trump agreed to, quote, cook the books, end quote, to cover up Mr. Cohen's $130,000 payment to the porn star Stormy Daniels. When Mr. Trump reimbursed Mr. Cohen, Mr. Colangelo said, Mr. Trump and his company falsified internal records, disguising the repayments as routine legal expenses.
Now this headline from the World and Nation pages of the Hartford Current. Court weighs outdoor sleeping bans. Oregon case comes as homelessness rising across nation. This by Lindsay Whitehurst and Claire Rush of the Associated Press. It is datelined Washington. The Supreme Court wrestled with a major question about the growing issue of homelessness on Monday, as it considered whether cities can punish people for sleeping outside when shelter space is lacking. It is the most significant case before the High Court in decades on the issue, and it comes as record numbers of people are without a permanent place to live in the United States. The case started in a rural Oregon town of Grants Pass, which began fining people $295 for sleeping outside as the cost of housing escalated and tents sprung up in the city's public parks. The San Francisco-based U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the law under its holding that banning camping in places without enough shelter beds amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. The justices appeared to be leaning toward a narrow ruling in the case after hearing arguments that showed the stark terms of the debate over homelessness in western states like California, which is home to one-third of the nation's homeless population. Sleeping is a biological necessity, and people may be forced to do it outside if they can't get housing or there's no space in shelters, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said. Quote, where do we put them if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this? Where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves, not sleeping? Unquote, she said. Solving homelessness is a complicated question, and Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who raised questions about both the role of federal courts and of camping bans, quote, how does it help if there are not enough beds for the number of homeless people in the jurisdiction, unquote, he said. Other conservative justices asked how far Eighth Amendment legal protections should extend as cities struggle with managing homeless encampments that can be dangerous and unsanitary. Quote, how about if there are no public bathroom facilities? Do people have an Eighth Amendment right to defecate and urinate outdoors? Unquote, said Justice Neil Gorsuch. Other public health laws cover that situation, Justice Department Attorney Edwin Needler said. He argued people shouldn't be punished just for sleeping outside, but said the ruling striking down the Grants Pass law should be tossed out because the court didn't do enough to determine if people are involuntarily homeless. Gorsuch and other justices also raised the possibility that other aspects of state or federal law could help sort through the issue, potentially without setting sweeping new legal precedents.
And from the New York Times, why Israel decided to pare down attack on Iran. This by Ronan Bergman and Patrick Kingsley. Israel abandoned plans for a much more extensive counterstrike on Iran after concerted diplomatic pressure from the United States and other foreign allies, and because the brunt of an Iranian assault on Israeli soil had been thwarted, according to three senior Israeli officials. Israeli leaders originally discussed bombarding several military targets across Iran last week, including near Tehran, the Iranian capital, in retaliation for the Iranian strike on April 13th, said the officials, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe the sensitive discussions. Such a broad and damaging attack would have been far harder for Iran to overlook, increasing the chances of a forceful Iranian counterattack that could have brought the Middle East to the brink of a major regional conflict. In the end, after President Biden, along with the British and German foreign ministers, urged Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to prevent a wider war, Israel opted for a more limited strike on Friday that avoided significant damage, diminishing the likelihood of an escalation, at least for now. Still, in the view of Israeli officials, the attack showed Iran the breadth and sophistication of Israel's military arsenal. Instead of sending jet fighters into Iranian airspace, Israel fired a small number of missiles from aircraft positioned several hundred miles west of it on Friday, according to the Israeli officials and two senior Western officials briefed on the attack. Israel also sent small attack drones, known as quadcopters, to infuse Iranian air defenses, according to the Israeli officials. Military facilities in Iran have been attacked by such drones several times in recent years, and on several occasions, Iran has said it did not know who the drones belonged to, a claim interpreted as Iranian reluctance to respond. One missile on Friday hit an anti-aircraft battery in a strategically important part of central Iran, while other exploded in midair, the official said. One Israeli official said that the Israeli Air Force intentionally destroyed the second missile once it became clear that the first had reached its target, to avoid causing too much damage. One Western official said it was possible the missile had simply malfunctioned. The official said Israel's intention was to allow Iran to move on without responding in kind, while signaling that Israel had developed the ability to strike Iran without entering its airspace or even setting off its air defense batteries. Israel also hoped to show that it could hit those batteries in a part of central Iran that houses several major nuclear facilities, including an uranium enrichment site in Natanz, hinting that it could also have reached those facilities if it had tried.
Back to the Hartford Current now for this headline. Pro-Palestinian protests sweep college campuses. This by Nick Perry, Michelle Price, and Dave Collins of the Associated Press. It is datelined New York. Columbia University canceled in-person classes, dozens of protesters were arrested at Yale, and the gates to Harvard Yard were closed to the public Monday, as some of the most prestigious U.S. universities sought to defuse campus tensions over Israel's war with Hamas. The various actions followed the arrest last week of more than 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators who had camped out on Columbia's Green, as schools struggle to draw the line between allowing free expression while maintaining a safe and inclusive campus. In addition to the demonstrations at the Ivy League schools, pro-Palestinian encampments have sprouted up on other campuses, including the University of Michigan, New York University, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The protests have pitted students against one another, with pro-Palestinian students demanding that their schools condemn Israel's assault on Gaza and divest from companies that sell weapons to Israel. Some Jewish students, meanwhile, say much of the criticism of Israel has veered into anti-Semitism and made them feel unsafe, and point out that Hamas is still holding hostages taken during the group's October 7th invasion. Tensions remained high Monday at Columbia in New York City, where the campus gates were locked to anyone without a school ID, and where protests broke out on campus and outside. Representative Kathy Manning, a Democrat from North Carolina, who is visiting Columbia with three other Jewish members of Congress to view the encampment, told reporters after meeting with students from the Jewish Law Students Association that there was, quote, an enormous encampment of people, unquote, who had taken up about a third of the green. Quoting again, we saw signs indicating that Israel should be destroyed, unquote, she said after leaving the Morningside Heights campus. A woman inside the campus gates led about two dozen protesters on the street outside in a chant of, quote, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, unquote. A charged phrase that can mean vastly different things to different groups. A small group of pro-Israel counter-demonstrators protested nearby. University President Manoush Shafik said in a message to the school community Monday that she was deeply saddened by what was happening on campus. Quote, to de-escalate the rancor and give us a chance to consider next steps, I am announcing that all classes will be held virtually on Monday, unquote, Shafik wrote, noting that faculty and staff should work remotely when possible and that students who don't live on campus should stay away.
And from the New York Times, in war's ruin, a stark reality is taking form. This by Julian E. Barnes, Adam Goldman, Eric Schmidt, and Adam Raskin. Israel's military operations in Gaza have weakened Hamas. Most Hamas battalions have been degraded and are scattered. Thousands of its members have been killed, and at least one senior military leader has been eliminated. Yet Israel has not achieved its primary goals of the war, freeing hostages and fully destroying Hamas. The war and the tactics of the Israel Defense Forces have come at a great cost. Vast numbers of Palestinian citizens have been killed in the Israeli campaign. Hunger is widespread in Gaza, and deaths around relief efforts have generated condemnation. 6 months into the conflict, the question of what Israel has achieved and when and how the fighting could come to an end is creating even more intense global strains around a war that has cost Israel support from even close allies. Israel's own military casualties have begun to climb, without about 260 killed and more than 1,500 injured since its pulverizing ground assault began in the weeks after the Hamas-led terrorist attacks on October 7th. Israeli officials say that about 133 of the hostages taken remain in Gaza, but talks to secure the return of at least some of them in exchange for a halt in the fighting and the release of Palestinian prisoners have hit a snag.